Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
Pilgrims and Palestinians celebrating in Bethlehem and in the Vatican. And Al-Shabaab attacks UN peacekeepers in Somalia. I'm Marty Johnson reporting from Washington.
Christmas celebrations kicked off in Bethlehem.
Gesù, il figlio di Dio, il salvatore del mondo.
That is Pope Francis delivering his second annual Christmas blessing to thousands of people gathered in St. Peter's Square, where he condemned what he called the brutal persecution of Christians in the Mideast and Africa. The Pope discussed many of the major conflicts and crises going on in the world and urged peace in places like Ukraine, Nigeria, and the Central African Republic, condemning last week's Taliban attack against students in Pakistan. The Pope also offered blessings for Ebola victims, particularly the people of Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea, as well as for those providing their care. Christmas is one of the holiest days for Christians, celebrating the birth of Jesus in Bethlehem 2,000 years ago. And security forces are on high alert in several countries this Christmas because of concern that radical Muslim groups could attack churches or Christian communities. In Indonesia, the world's largest Muslim-majority country, security officials have deployed more than 150,000 policemen and military personnel across the country to deter acts of violence against Christians. Somali group Al-Shabaab has attacked an African Union peacekeeping force base in Somalian capital Mogadishu. A spokesman for the AU mission, Ali Hamoud, tells VOA 7 to 10 Al-Shabaab gunmen entered the compound. Two attackers detonated suicide bombs, three others were killed in gunfire, and two more still remain inside the compound but are now surrounded by troops. The spokesman said there are casualties among the AU troops but didn't have details. This is VOA News. Sony Pictures is now distributing the controversial comedy, The Interview, online. 200 independent theaters will screen the movie today throughout the United States. Sony had pulled the film from general release last week after several large U.S. theater chains said they would not show it because of threats of violence. The comedy tells the story of two journalists who are recruited by U.S. intelligence to assassinate North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. North Korea condemned the movie, and unknown attackers hacked Sony Pictures' computer website earlier this month, stealing valuable, highly confidential information and products. The U.S. blames North Korea for the cyber attack, a charge which Pyongyang denies. China leads the world in executions, sentencing thousands of people to death every year. There are, however, signs the Chinese government is reducing the number of crimes punishable by death. Shannon Van Sant reports from Beijing.
Earlier this year, China announced plans to remove 9 crimes from the list of capital offenses, including counterfeiting, fraudulent fundraising, and forcing others into prostitution. The move came as Chinese President Xi Jinping sought to crack down on corruption. In 2011, China dropped 13 offenses from its list of crimes punishable by the death penalty, and these policy changes are having impact. Last year, China executed 2,400 people. While that is still more executions than the rest of the world combined, it is a 20% drop from 2002, when China executed 12,000 people. Shannon Van Sant for VOA News, Beijing.
Syrian activists said today Kurdish fighters in northeastern Syria have reclaimed the town of Qasayib after fighting with Islamic State group militants that killed at least 30 of the militants. The extremists seized the area earlier this week in Hasaka province near the Turkish border. Meantime, the father of a Jordanian captured by the militants in Syria is pleading with the rebel group for his son's, who is a fighter pilot's safe return. The father appealed to the religious extremists to treat First Lieutenant Muath al-Qasisaba as a guest, not a hostage, telling them, "We are all Muslims." Jordan says it is stepping up its efforts to secure the release of the pilot captured by the militants on Wednesday after his jet crashed in a militant-controlled area of Syria. This man is the spokesman for the Jordanian government.
At this point, with the little information we have, I think what we can say is that the government will take every necessary step needed in order to secure his coming back to his home and his family.
The U.S. general overseeing the U.S.-led coalition fighting Islamic State in Syria and Iraq denied the militants shot down the plane and strongly condemned IS for capturing the downed pilot. I'm Marty Johnson reporting from Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. Coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
For the second Christmas in a row, Martin's family will have to celebrate Christmas apart. Martin says she not only misses her mom and brothers, she also misses rushing home after Christmas service to help prepare a Christmas feast for the whole family.
That's reporter Mugume Davis Rawakarinji describing Christmas for thousands internally displaced people in South Sudan. Details coming up also in the news. Journalists and political opponents in Burundi claim electoral fraud. And in this Christmas season, a non-profit foundation in Ghana is encouraging children in deprived communities to turn their lives around. We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sonny Young, music from Sierra Leone, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story this hour, an African Union peacekeeping base in the Somali capital Mogadishu is under attack from militants. Witnesses reported gunfire and explosions at the base, which is near the city's airport. The Islamist militant group Al-Shabaab has claimed responsibility for the assault. An Al-Shabaab spokesman told Reuters News Service that Al-Shabaab fighters forced their way onto the base where gunfire was continuing. Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni's ruling National Resistance Movement has given him additional political powers ahead of possible changes to the constitution. Elizabeth Polat in Kampala reports on what this means for the future of one of Africa's longest-serving leaders.
At the NRM delegates conference in mid-December, a monumental shift took place. More than 10,000 delegates assembled in Kampala approved a motion allowing the party chairman, President Museveni, to appoint or dismiss party leaders. Prior to this conference, the NRM elected leaders by popular vote. In less than a week, the president used those powers and the NRM announced a shakeup in the party's top offices. First to go was the man who presented the biggest challenge to Mr. Museveni, NRM Secretary General Amama Mbabazi, who had been dismissed as Prime Minister months earlier. The Treasurer, Deputy Secretary General, and Electoral Commission Chairman were replaced as well. Silver Kayando, a lawyer who worked on the NRM Legal Committee for the conference, says the consolidation of power is a good move to make politics more efficient.
NRM is a political party desirous of maintaining its political power and rule. So if they've deemed it fit that through the party chairman having more power is what will deliver them victory to maintain their hold on power, so be it. I don't see it. Power is there to be exercised, and he definitely, the party chairman in my view, should have power. Right now, politically, Museveni is stronger. He displayed a lot of political genius. He was able to play his cards straight.
The consolidation of party power comes at a crucial time. The Uganda Law Reform Commission is currently reviewing a number of proposed amendments to the Constitution, including allowing the government to seize land for investment purposes. This comes ahead of Uganda's plan to award new oil and gas exploration licenses in 2015, after a seven-year moratorium. The discovery of gas and oil reserves has led to an increase in land disputes and claims. Other proposed constitutional changes would allow the president to direct police policies and make it tougher for members of parliament to shift political alliances. This is not surprising given the recent history of swift crackdowns on political opponents, including the repeated jailings of Kizza Besigye, a former presidential candidate. President Museveni is a former rebel leader who has been in power since 1986. He has won four elections in the past 20 years, but critics say that is because he stacked the deck, engineered an easy election for himself. The last election in 2011 was widely criticized as flawed. So it is not surprising to human rights activists that one of the proposed constitutional amendments not being considered is the restoration of term limits. The two-term limit was scrapped in 2005 by constitutional amendment, allowing the president to run for his third and fourth terms. At the same time, restrictions on political pluralism were also put in place. Livingstone Siwanyana, of the Foundation for Human Rights Initiative, says he believes the latest move to increase the president's powers is to counter early any possible challenge ahead of the 2016 elections.
The mere fact that all the powers were conferred on the one person to choose and elect the other category of leaders within the party could be worrying in the sense that it symbolizes how governance will be affected in this country. Yes, I would say yes, it raises a fundamental issue as the extent to which power is shared and the freedom to which citizens can make choices. Of course, our concern is that we need to have a level playing field as we go towards 2016.
Mr. Museveni's 28 years in power make him one of Africa's longest-serving leaders on a continent that has close to a dozen presidents for life, rulers whose continued power is unchallenged. The president has not officially announced his candidacy for a fifth term, but it seems clear that the NRM is setting the stage for another term in office for Mr. Museveni. An official announcement is expected to come in the next 6 months. Lisbeth Pola, VOA News, Kampala, Uganda.
Reports of beatings, intimidation, and extortion in the Southeast African country of Burundi have raised fears of increasing political repression ahead of elections in May. Recently, the violence has calmed, but rights activists, journalists, and political opponents of the ruling party claim it has been replaced with electoral fraud. Anna McNeish reports from the capital, Bujumbura.
Burundi's Interior Minister Edouard Nduwimana has dismissed reports by international rights organizations that earlier this year accused the government of detaining and harassing critics. They also charged the ruling party with backing elements within its youth party, called the Imbonerakure, which are accused of mass extortion and widespread violence against civilians. He says he thinks one should be suspicious of the people who do these reports. Do they actually come in and look at the security situation of the country? Nduwimana also denies the findings of a leaked UN report that accuses certain generals and politicians allied to the government of distributing weapons to youth members, some of whom were allegedly taken to nearby Democratic Republic of Congo for military training. The violence reportedly stopped a few weeks ago, but veteran rights defender Pierre Claver Mbonimpa says that's only because of the international outcry. He says the ruling party has changed its tactics and is now rigging votes instead. He says that's why things are a bit calmer, only because other activities are underway, like going after voters at registration. Activists say they've seen buses transporting youths from one area to another and being issued several voting cards. Burundi's 12-year civil war ended in 2005, but it is one of the world's poorest and hungriest countries. Large numbers of illiterate youths ally themselves to politicians as the surest way to get a slice of the pie in a hugely corrupt country where a booming population and shrinking land are a major source of conflict. In short, votes can be easily bought. But Pierre Claver Ndayikariye, who presides over what journalists, civil society members and rival political parties say is not an independent electoral commission, says most of this talk is just political speculation by untrustworthy people with an agenda.
Ils ne disent pas fraude électorale seulement. Ils disent fraude électorale massive.
He says be careful of the excessive vocabulary of politicians and certain civil society representatives. He acknowledges that certain citizens, certain militant members of political parties, have more than one ID card, which is not normal. A coalition of 18 political parties has threatened to boycott elections unless the Electoral Commission is dissolved and a reliable registration process put in place. Mbonimpa says that if the demands of these political parties are not met, rival youth party members will take to the streets and take on the Imbonerakure.
Si les choses continuent comme ils ont commencé, si on continue.
He says if things continue and the government goes ahead with elections that have these errors and mistakes, the opposition parties won't tolerate it, the youth won't tolerate it, and there will definitely be violence. Nduwimana, on the other hand, says there is zero probability of next year's elections turning bloody. But some international charities are already planning for the worst. Hannah McNeish for VOA in Bujumbura, Burundi.
A new study in the medical journal The Lancet asks how sub-Saharan Africa can fund the fight against AIDS when donors are tightening their budgets. For countries such as South Africa, Botswana, and Namibia, AIDS funding comes from domestic resources. Other countries, such as Mozambique and Ethiopia, depend on international donor funds to finance their AIDS spending. Dr. Robert Hecht is managing director for the Washington, D.C.-based NGO Results for Development Institute. He's also one of the authors of the study. He explained to reporter Kim Lewis the timeliness of the study for Africa.
This study is very timely because at this moment, many of the countries in Africa most affected by HIV are trying to expand their prevention and treatment activities. This is going to cost more money over the next few years, but the question of where the funding will come from is complicated. Our study contains some very good news because it shows that the countries themselves can pick up a larger share of the cost of these expanded HIV programs. This means that the donor agencies like PEPFAR and the Global Fund can focus their remaining resources on the countries that are not able to cover the cost of these AIDS programs entirely and will still depend on some amount of outside support. So this is a critical moment in the response to the AIDS epidemic. We know that treatment programs are working. We know that treatment also has a preventive effect. It slows down the rate of transmission of HIV. We have more tools on the prevention side, like medical male circumcision. All of these things cost quite a bit of money. So the balance between the national funding, the domestic funding, and the outside funding needs to be rethought or recalibrated. And our study feeds right into that discussion and debate.
What are some countries that continue to be more reliant on outside funding?
Our study, which was carried out by a team including myself and one of our colleagues, Professor Stephen Resch from the Harvard School of Public Health and others, showed that in some of the countries with the highest HIV burden and low incomes, these are poor countries with serious AIDS epidemics, like the country Mozambique or Tanzania, even if the countries step up and are able to finance a larger share of the cost of their national AIDS programs, it still looks like PEPFAR and the other donors, the Global Fund and other outside funding sources will still need to be there in a big measure. Even under the maximum, most optimistic scenario, we would estimate that a country like Mozambique won't be able to cover more than about 25% of the cost of its AIDS program. They're going to need quite a bit of support for many years to come from PEPFAR and from others. On the other hand, there are countries in Africa such as South Africa and Namibia with stronger economies, very serious AIDS epidemics, but much stronger economies. And our study shows that over time, these countries can progressively take over the cost of their AIDS programs, can pay for them themselves, and can, in the next few years, potentially even see the outside financing end so that their dependence goes to zero and they're able to be more self-reliant.
That was Dr. Robert Hecht, Managing Director for the Washington, D.C.-based NGO Results for Development Institute. He spoke with my colleague Kim Lewis from Paris, France. You are listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. 19 past the hour, here's a recap of our top stories. Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni's party has given him additional political powers ahead of possible changes to the constitution. Journalists and political opponents in Burundi claim electoral fraud. And in this Christmas season, a nonprofit foundation in Ghana is encouraging children in deprived communities to turn their lives around. And we'd like to hear your thoughts on our stories. You can write to us at Africa News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest Washington, D.C., 20237. Pope Francis has delivered his second annual Christmas blessing to the thousands of people gathered in St. Peter's Square, where he condemned what he called the brutal persecution of minorities by the Islamic State group that seized large parts of Syria and Iraq earlier this year. The Pope discussed many of the major conflicts and crises going on in the world, urging peace in places like Ukraine, Nigeria, and the Central African Republic, and condemning last week's Taliban attack against students in Pakistan. The Pope also offered blessings for the victims of Ebola, particularly the people of Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea, as well as for those providing care. Meanwhile, in the West Bank town of Bethlehem yesterday, Christians gathered at the Church of the Nativity for services at the site where they believe Jesus was born. The Latin Patriarch of Jerusalem, Archbishop Fawud Tawal, led morning prayers attended by hundreds of people. This Christmas season, some young Ghanaians are bringing smiles to the faces of children in deprived communities. Members of nonprofit I Have Foundation are not only sharing gifts, but using the opportunity to encourage children to turn their lives around. Joanna Manti reports from Accra.
I Have is an initiative to inspire young people to action and improve the quality of their lives. In places where people see challenges, the I Have group sees opportunities to make a difference in society. Members, mostly in their 20s, work on projects targeting youth. Satya Abubakar is in charge of media affairs.
I Have stands for youth empowerment and giving the youth direction. A lot of the youth, they are there, they have their vision with them, but they don't know what to do. We inspire them to put their vision into action.
Yes.
We look for a problem and then we solve it.
One project called Pieces to Peace aims at meeting the needs of underprivileged children, including orphans and those living in abject poverty. Through social media networks, the public can donate pieces of ribbon, cloth, and handbags that can be made into new dresses and other gifts.
Most people, when it comes to Christmas and New Year, appeal for used clothes, used shoes. But we decided to give the children something brand new they can call their own. We did a collaboration with another NGO called Dress a Kid.
Some dress designers and tailors also offered free services to help make the project a success. So far, 200 children have benefited from the scheme, which started last year. They include children from 5 orphanages, such as Teshi Orphanage and Streetwise Orphanage in Accra. The dresses are designed from African prints. Satya said the objective is to encourage recipients to value the concept of African culture and beauty. It is also to get the designers to show off their handiwork. She said the reaction of the children to the last donation was very touching.
And the reaction was just awesome. The emotions they displayed that day, you know, it was like they started the new year with new clothes. When we are even about to leave, some of them were clinched to some of them. They don't even want to leave.
This year's program will see the distribution of books and stationery to deprived schools in the Greater Accra area and in Ghana's northern regions. Satya said the goal of the book project is to teach the children simple systems of handling and rotating books among readers. It is also to teach them ways of managing small libraries where books are kept in school cupboards. I Have believes healthy and contented children have the chance of achieving their dreams and contributing to national development. Joanna Manti for VOA News.
For hundreds of thousands of South Sudanese, this Christmas is being spent in camps for internally displaced persons, or IDPs. Reporter Mugume Davis Rawakarinji met with some in a United Nations camp in Juba as they prepared for their second Christmas in a country divided.
Aria, This 14-square-meter structure in the UN House IDP camp in Juba has no walls. The roof is a plastic sheet, but the thousands of IDPs living here have turned this ramshackle house into a place of worship. Days before Christmas, the makeshift church is bustling as the choir rehearses for Mass to celebrate the birth of Christ. One of the church leaders, William Dengbiar, believes Christmas is an opportunity for all South Sudanese to unite.
We want to tell people that Jesus will be born among us. He will be born in our heart, and we want to live in peace. We want to receive Jesus with love. We want to receive Jesus with hope, as well as peace in our country. That is what we want to give for people in Southern Sudan.
Not far from the church, 15-year-old Nyai Lei Martin remembers what Christmas was like before South Sudan plunged into violence.
She says
that in 2012, the year before fighting broke out in South Sudan, the family feasted on chicken and many different foods on Christmas Day. There were many people at her house that year. 2013 was very different. Martin was living in Juba with her father and young sister when fighting broke out in the capital on December 15 last year. She was going to school. Her father worked for the government. The rest of the family, her mother and two brothers, were in Bentiu. Bentiu is one of the towns in South Sudan that have been devastated by the year-long conflict. For the second Christmas in a row, Martin's family will have to celebrate Christmas apart. Martin says she not only misses her mom and brothers, she also misses rushing home after Christmas service to help prepare a Christmas feast for the whole family. Chudiel Garichol fled to UN House for his life when the fighting broke out in Juba last December. He left his wife and children at home. His family eventually made it to Ethiopia. He is in this camp for IDPs.
I feel very pain, but because we are in war in South Sudan, what can I do? I want to bring them here, but I don't have salary to bring them here. No money. They will celebrate there. I will be celebrated here. It is very painful to me, but what can I do?
34-year-old Deng Diang Chol also ran to the UN House base with his wife and two children on December 19th last year, 4 days after fighting erupted. He likes to remember how the family celebrated Christmas before the conflict.
We used to go to the church after Christmas, so we went to visit family, yeah, relative, so that we enjoy Christmas. Where we have different type of food. Sometimes you can go and eat meat, sometimes you can go and eat chicken, sometimes you can eat pepper food, sometimes you can eat local food called walwal.
Chol never imagined he would spend even one Christmas in the camp, let alone two.
We were hoping that if international community intervene to bring peace, so that we may go outside.
But he says even though he's one of nearly 2 million South Sudanese who have been displaced by the fighting, he's lucky because his family is still intact. They'll be celebrating Christmas together in this camp for IDPs. And like many others here, they'll be wishing and praying for peace. For VOA News, I am Mugume Davis Ruakarinj in Juba.
This is Africa News Tonight. I'm Hayes Wuhib in Washington. It's 29 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
This is a public service announcement from VOA Africa. U.S. President Barack Obama addressing the Ebola crisis.
Hello. I want to take a few moments to speak directly to you, the people of West Africa. On behalf of the American people, I want you to know that our prayers are with those of you who have lost loved ones during this terrible outbreak of Ebola. Along with our partners around the world, the United States is working with your governments to help stop this disease. Stopping this disease won't be easy, but we know how to do it. Together, we can treat those who are sick with respect and dignity. We can save lives. And our countries can work together to improve public health so this kind of outbreak doesn't happen again. In this urgent work and in building a stronger and more prosperous Africa, you'll continue to have a partner in me and in the United States of America.
This was a public service announcement from VOA Africa.
This is Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America, and here is a brief recap of our top stories this hour. Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni's party has given him additional political powers ahead of possible changes to the constitution. Journalists and political opponents in Burundi claim electoral fraud. And in this Christmas season, a nonprofit foundation in Ghana is encouraging children in deprived communities to turn their lives around. Coming up, music from Sierra Leone. And in our feature segment, the NGO Light for the World, dedicated to improving eye health for people in developing countries. I'm Yehiz Wuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. Time now for the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young. Merry Christmas to you, Sunny.
Merry Christmas, Yehiz. And Merry Christmas to all our Voice of America listeners celebrating the holiday. One of the big football stories in 2014 was Germany defeating Argentina 1-0 in extra time to lift its fourth World Cup title. In this sunny side of sports highlight for 2014, our football guru David Legg looks back on Germany's triumph.
I enjoyed it, Sonny. Okay, there was only one goal, but I think both teams were pressing. Argentina, they certainly had their share of chances. But in the end, I think Germany were worthy winners, both of the final and of the tournament. And I was just struck, Sonny, by the winning goal from the man who now in South Africa is known as Super Mario. It's Mario Götze, the substitute who came on. The way he just took the ball down and fired it past the Argentinian goalkeeper. And the view here in South Africa, Sonny, was that if an African player was in a similar position, he would have tried to do about five or six things first before actually shooting at goal. And looking back on the tournament, Sonny, that's the thing that struck me, is with the African sides, we just didn't take our chances. We had probably as many chances as the South Americans and the Europeans. But the Götze goal will remain long in my memory as a brilliant piece of clinical finishing. The Germans pushed the ball down the left wing. The ball came across, just missed the Argentinian defender. Götze, he got it on his chest and bang, the ball was in the net. And I think maybe that's what divides, Sonny, the great teams of the World Cups, the Italys, the Germanys, in former years, the Brazil, I admit, not in 2014. From the Nigerias, the Ghanas, the Ivory Coast, it's that clinical finishing touch. And it certainly was a goal worthy of winning any final. And really, Sonny, a great tournament overall. I mean, we were all, I think, a bit concerned about Brazil in the lead-up. There was talk of chaos, and they were so far behind with their stadiums and other infrastructure. And there's no doubt that the Brazilians, I think, left things to the last minute, and some of the infrastructure clearly was not finished on time, and other infrastructure simply didn't get done at all. But on the field, Sonny, it was great. I mean, we had 171 goals, equals the record for a 32-nation tournament set in France in 1998. And, you know, when we go to the stadiums or when we turn on our TV sets or when we go to the internet or we listen to the Voice of America.
Voice of America!
What we're really after, above all else, is a close, exciting game and plenty of goals. And I think we got those in abundance. So well done to the teams and well done to Brazil.
David, in terms of the goals, Colombia's Rodriguez wins the Golden Boot as the World Cup's top scorer with 6 goals. Argentina's Messi wins the Golden Ball as the World Cup's best player. A bit controversial, perhaps, David. Some saying that maybe it should have gone to Rodriguez or even one of the German players, Mueller, or their great goaltender. Your thoughts?
Yes, Sonny. Here in South Africa, this has been the big subject of debate, is Messi winning the Golden Ball. The feeling is, among a lot of people listening to radio shows, that perhaps his reputation helped him to get that award. And there's a general consensus that while Messi did play his role in Argentina getting to the final, he scored some vital goals. I think back, for example, to the one against Iran in stoppage time. At the same time, he certainly didn't have a great World Cup. I think he had a good World Cup. We didn't see the Messi that we know from some of those brilliant performances for Barcelona. It's interesting, Sonny, the names that you mentioned, because another name cropped up here, and that was Robin from the Netherlands. And what might have gone against Robin is his admittance that he sometimes dives in the goal mouth, and that, I think, might have counted against him, because FIFA, they're always putting great stress on fair play. I don't think it was scandalous that Messi won the award, but you're right, Sonny. I think, for example, Neuer, the German goalkeeper, he must have been a very strong candidate, and he did win what they call the Golden Glove for the best goalkeeper. But yes, interesting decision. I think there were a lot of people who felt it was deserved of Messi, and a lot of others, Sonny, who feel that perhaps he was a little bit lucky, and also that his name almost carried him to the title. And of course, it would have been fascinating if Neymar hadn't have been injured, because I think his absence from the semi-final and the third-place match really emphasized, Sonny, just how important he was to the Brazilian team. We only really missed him when he wasn't there anymore. And, of course, Brazil, after that 7-1 hiding, they probably thought nothing like this will ever happen again. And a couple of days later, they get a 3-goal hiding from the Dutch in the third-place playoff. And that has now cost their coach, Scolari, his job. I think, Sonny, after the result against the Dutch, it was pretty inevitable.
David, you talk about the Dutch, one of three World Cup teams to finish the tournament undefeated, as you told our listeners recently on the Voice of America.
Voice of America!
Matches that are determined by penalty kicks officially go into the books as draws. And so the three undefeated teams in Brazil were Germany, the Netherlands, and Costa Rica. Your thoughts on the Dutch, David? Maybe just a little bad luck, couldn't get them to the final?
Yes, I mean, you know, these penalty shootouts, it seems to be so much hinges on those first few kicks. Costa Rica got off to a bad start against the Dutch in their shootout, and then they lost it. And the Dutch, of course, got off to a bad start against Argentina. The one team, Sonny, I will always back in the shootout are the Germans. As that final approached the 120th minute and it was still goalless before Götze struck, I said to myself, if this goes to a shootout, my money is on the Germans. I don't know what it is, Sonny. It's something in their DNA that just makes them great at the shootouts.
That's our football guru, David Legg.
The Voice of America, VOA.
The Confederation of African Football will hold its annual awards gala January 8th in Lagos, Nigeria. Ivorian star Yaya Toure is bidding for his fourth consecutive African Footballer of the Year prize. Looking back to January 2014, music played a big role at the last CAF Awards ceremony, as we hear now from our friend in Lagos, Segun Dot on the spot at Adeyemi.
Nigerian superstar D'Banj, setting the stage for what became a night of glee and glamour. There was plenty of music at the ceremony, held annually to celebrate the best in African football. But by far the best musical performance of the night was by the masked Nigerian star, Lagbaja, who provided the right ambience for the most coveted award, the African Footballer of the Year, won by Ivorian and Manchester City player, Yaya Toure, former Nigerian national team captain, Sunday Olise, one of the two compares for the night, announced today as the winner.
And this is personal, for me personally. The winner is Yaya Toure.
Toure beat Nigerian and Chelsea star John Mikel Obi to the second place, while another Ivorian, Didier Drogba, was third.
Hi, Didier Drogba, striker from Ivory Coast.
Toure says he's very proud and happy to win the award and paid tribute to Mikel Obi in particular, an act that attracted applause from the crowd.
To be here today, I think, is unbelievable, you know, and I'm very proud and very happy to be the winner today.
I full congratulate my brother as well, Obi Mikael, who deserves it as well. And to be the winner today was unbelievable, you know, for the people who helped me a lot and the people around me, with my family, support me for a long time. I think this award today was is unbelievable. I'm very, very proud, very happy, and thank you for everything. Thank you.
The award for the African Footballer of the Year based in Africa went to Mohamed Aboutrika, the 35-year-old Egyptian legend who plays for Al Ahly of the North African nation. Aboutrika has now won the award for an unprecedented fourth time. Though Nigeria missed out of the Most Coveted African Footballer of the Year award, the country swept most of the other awards. Nigeria won the National Team of the Year and the Youth National Team of the Year. Nigerian supporters won the Fair Play Award, while Nigeria's head coach Stephen Keshi won the Coach of the Year award. Keshi was also named as coach of Africa's 11 that included Nigerian goaltender Vincent Nyama. Also, Nigeria's Kelechi Iheanacho won the Most Promising Talent award, while Nigeria's president Goodluck Jonathan bagged the 2013 CAF Platinum award for his country's success in football during the year. The CAF Legend award 2013 was given posthumously to Bruno Metsu, the French coach who took Senegal to the quarterfinal of the 2002 FIFA World Cup, and Brazilian coach Medi Faria, who made Morocco the first African nation to reach the second round of the FIFA World Cup in 1986. Metsu died in October 2013 at the age of 59, while Faria died the same month and year at the age of 80. Other awards of the night are Club of the Year, won by Egyptian club Al Ahly, and the Referee of the Year, won by Algerian referee Hamoudi Jamel for the second successive year. Just as it started, the 2013 Gold Cup Awards was wrapped up with music by Nigeria's sensational pop twins, P-Square.
I'm VOA's Sonny Young, and that's the sunny side of sports. Back to you, Hayes Woohee.
Thank you, Sonny, and listen to the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 16:31 UTC and 18:31 UTC. And on Friday, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the sunny side of sports at 17:30 UTC right here on The Voice of America. Coming up, the NGO Light for the World, dedicated to improving eye health for people in developing countries. And next, engineers at Ugandan Kira Motors Corporation recently unveiling a prototype hybrid electric vehicle. But first, some music. Here is Sierra Leone's RJ with Change the World.
RJ. What's going on? World, hey. It's getting so cold. Ooh yeah, it's up to you and me. Ooh to yeah, make that change that the world badly needs. Yeah. What's going on in the world? The world. It's getting so cold. It's getting so cold. Little children's crying out. The only search heart. Oh yeah. And soon you will find that it's not that so hard. To love you, my brother. To tell you I care. To treat you the same way I want to treat you.
to tell me the reason for the hate. All the hate. You are my brother, can't you see?
And lust becomes the order of the day. Constantly confused and losing the real meaning of life. People preaching equality, but I ain't seen no practice. All I see is the world's getting cold.
Sierra Leone's RJ with Change the World. Light for the World is dedicated to improving eye health for people in developing countries. The NGO has worked to eradicate trachoma, a preventable disease of the eye that is still common in many parts of Ethiopia. With project partners, the NGO also restores the vision of those suffering from cataracts and glaucoma. Kim Lewis visited the Kweha Eye Hospital in Mekelle in northern Ethiopia and learned what it takes to help Ethiopians to see again.
Here at the Kweha Eye Hospital Vision Center, patients young and old wait their turn to see the eye doctor. Their ailments range from eye infections that could lead to disease to those already displaying serious eye diseases such as cataract, glaucoma, or diabetic retinopathy. In the center's eye clinic, an optometrist examines their eyes and discusses treatment options with the patients. Nuwani Mohammed Hagos is an optometrist at the eye clinic.
From an optometrist, the expecting thing to do in this hospital is first we do the refraction part. First, before we refract, we just do the slit lamp examination. All the steps done for refraction, but first we have to exclude the disease parts and we see the slit lamp. If there is any disease, we just treat that disease first before refraction and then we do refraction.
The slit lamp device is a low-power microscope combined with a high-intensity light source that can produce a thin beam of light. Dr. Nuwan Hagos sits on one side of the device, the patient on the other. She asks the patient to rest his or her chin in a small cradle of the device and sit forward so their forehead presses against it. Dr. Hagos examines the front of the eye, which includes the eyelids, cornea, conjunctive, sclera, and iris, for disease. She gives the patient eye drops to dilate their pupils and once again examines parts of his or her eyes with the slit lamp, this time with a smaller lens held close to the eye to see the back of the eye. Dr. Hagos can detect such diseases as corneal injury, retinitis pigmentosa, macular degeneration, glaucoma, and cataracts. In addition, the optometrist uses a biometry device to obtain vital statistics regarding the eye.
Another thing, preoperatively for cataract surgery, we do biometry, the A-scan biometry. We measure the keratometry and then the biometry, and then we send for appointment for cataract surgery.
Light for the World says cataracts are the leading cause of loss of sight for some 20 million people. Cataracts cause a person's vision to be cloudy or fuzzy, and it may cause the person to be very sensitive to light, causing a glare in vision. Most cataract cases are age-related. However, it can also occur after accidents or infections. In addition, some children are born with cataracts. Cataract surgeries are performed on a daily basis at the Vision Center in Mekelle. The patient undergoes the surgery and is released to go home the same day. The patient receives a local anesthetic, and the ophthalmologist or eye surgeon replaces the cloudy or opaque lens with a clear artificial lens in a 15-minute procedure. Little risk is involved in the surgery, and the patient's eyesight is restored to a clearer vision.
Commonly, there is cataract a lot. There is also glaucoma. nowadays, refractive errors are also improving the numbers. The awareness of the population is increasing, and they are coming for our clinic for refraction. Thus, the refractive error is also now common this year.
Dr. Hagos says she enjoys helping people.
Really, I really like optometry, and I'm enjoying my work.
Light for the World reports that in 2013, more than 55,000 cataract surgeries were performed through Project Partners, and another 15,100 eyelid surgeries have relieved the suffering of patients. Almost a million patients have been treated for eye diseases through the eye health programs, and more than a million people have received sight-saving drugs through distribution.
Engineers at Uganda's Kira Motors Corporation recently unveiled a prototype of its sedan hybrid electric vehicle, dubbed the Kira EV SMAC. The car manufacturer is slated to start commercial production of the Kira brand vehicles and passenger buses by 2018. VOA's Paul Ndiho has more from Kampala.
People are likely to ask, what kind of car is that? And the answer is, it's the Kira EV SMAC, an improved version of the Kira EV car that was first unveiled in 2011. For those who dare to be bold, the Kira EV SMAC has a striking design, one that commands attention. Kira Motors, a corporation, recently gave the Voice of America exclusive behind-the-scenes access. So let's get inside for a test drive. It drives and feels like any regular sedan on the market. And for those who had any doubts, it's time to let everyone know that this sedan has arrived. Kira Motors is a Ugandan government project under the Presidential Initiative for Science and Technology Innovations program. The project is aimed at establishing a framework for commercial production of Ugandan-made cars. Dr. Sande Stevens at Tagboa is the executive director of the Kira EV project.
We're now targeting the third quarter of 2018, when we think we should begin to roll out, say, about 300 of these cars off the assembly line. But we're creating a capacity of about 850 per year as a start.
The five-seater sedan is powered by a rechargeable battery, and it also has an internal combustion engine, a generator, which charges the battery.
All these were installed here manually. We haven't had any automation at all in this place. And this is young people you see around here who were involved in this.
Paul Isaac Musasizi, Chief Innovation and Technology Officer of Kira Motors, says that a Kira EV SMAC has impressive power and is designed to thrill.
The Kira SMAC platform is a platform which comes with three powertrain options, the conventional ICE powertrain, the full electric vehicle powertrain, and the hybrid electric vehicle powertrain, which this concept actually is.
Once in mass production, a Kira EV SMAC will be available in three packaging options: the two-door, the four-door or full-size sedan, and the five-door hatchback. This car was recently displayed at a public exhibition in Nairobi, Kenya. Akuvuku Albert is the chief operating officer.
We needed to seek partnerships, working with other stakeholders. If, for instance, there are people in Nairobi, Kenya, manufacturing glasses for cars, we don't have to reinvent the wheel and manufacture glasses here.
Kira EV SMAC is sleek with leather interior and smooth transition lines across the vehicle. The creative team at Kira Motors has the capacity, the drive, and the passion to make this dream a reality. Doreen Orishaba is one of the engineers.
Very exciting to be part of such a team that is going to transform Uganda.
Meanwhile, Kira Motors already has its sights set on expanding the brand to include a 32 solar-powered Kayola passenger buses. Kayola bus is another innovation made by Ugandans for Ugandans.
Industry analysts say Kampala's fast-growing population and rapid urban development has meant more cars on the road, and having locally manufactured passenger buses could ease the crush of people using public transportation.
That was reporter Paul Ndiho with a look at a new car manufactured in Uganda from Kira Motors Corporation. This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24-7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. On behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Bill Barber, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The world's fisheries are a natural resource that provides employment for over 50 million people and food for billions. Despite the resource's great importance, though, its health and sustainability are increasingly under threat. Illegal, unreported, and unregulated fishing is a major environmental problem and an economic challenge. The United States is committed to improving fisheries management, protecting the oceans, and safeguarding this marine bounty for generations to come. Toward this end, a special presidentially appointed task force on December 16th released recommendations for a framework for our nation to follow to combat illegal, unreported, and unregulated fishing and seafood fraud. The goal is a more systematic, coordinated domestic approach and greater U.S. leadership internationally on these issues. The recommendations would apply equally to U.S. and foreign seafood. One focuses on our government engaging with international partners to strengthen fisheries management and enforcement around the globe. One important step is convincing more nations to join into the Port State Measures Agreement, a binding global instrument to combat illegal, unreported, and unregulated fishing. Another calls for a program to trace the sources of seafood brought to market. According to the U.S. National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, a fisheries regulator, U.S. fishermen last year landed 9.9 billion pounds of fish and shellfish worth $5.5 billion. Globally, annual losses attributable to illegal, unreported, and unregulated fishing have been estimated at $10 to $23 billion. These practices fuel trafficking operations while undermining economic opportunities for fishermen and seafood companies engaged in legal fishing. Vessels fishing in restricted waters or exceeding their limits gain an unfair advantage over law-abiding fishing operations. For example, some pay no licensing fees, denying governments needed revenues for protecting their resources. After a review period for public comment on implementation of the recommendations, the task force will develop an action plan. The United States will continue to work with partners around the world to promote the proper management of marine resources for the benefit of future generations.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
On Africa News Tonight, we let the sound tell the story, putting you in the middle of events from Africa's news to world crises. Africa News Tonight comes to you live from the Voice of America on the following shortwave frequencies, 6080 kilohertz and 15580 kilohertz. We are also live on the internet at www.voaafrica.com.